Lake Effect continues now. I'm Bonnie Knorr. Thanks for joining us. As we explore race relations in Milwaukee, we're also attempting to quantify just how segregated Milwaukee is. And while segregation is a complex issue with historical and political implications, you may often hear one of its root causes boiled down to a simple phrase, white flight. In its recent history, Milwaukee has experienced periods of so-called white flight, in which whites moved out of areas of the city and eventually into the suburbs once African Americans had the chance to expand outside of the city's inner core. But Amanda Seligman doesn't entirely buy into the idea of so-called white flight, saying changes in neighborhoods are much more complex than a simple phrase can convey. Seligman is a professor of history and the director of the Urban Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She tells Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce how the concept of white flight is often oversimplified.
White flight gets used in two different ways, I think. Most commonly in America is the kind of more simple idea that whites, when confronted with the possibility that African Americans will move into their neighborhood, just leave right away. And a second, less common use, but is one that's used nonetheless in some of the scholarship, is the general notion of white abandonment of institutions that blacks have taken advantage of or taken the opportunity to be part of in one way or another. So the idea that once there's a sizable black population in a city, whites generally leave, or once blacks start using parks, whites leave. Basically, the idea that whites take their tax dollars and their bodies out of places once blacks go in.
How does this oversimplify what's really going on when we kind of misconstrue then what white flight is?
Yeah, well, white flight is this really appealing term, right? It rhymes, it sounds good, it gives us this kind of intuitive sense we know what it means. And that's been true, I think, the whole time it's been used. But I think if you look closely at the processes that people use to call white flight, you see that there's a much more complicated set of processes underneath, some of which have very little to do with actually the whites themselves who are supposedly doing the fleeing. Sort of underneath the idea of white flight, what's really going on is that whites were making a set of decisions about what to do when faced with a possibility that blacks would move into their neighborhoods, 1950s, 1960s, and they took a variety of responses. Sometimes they did just leave, but I think often they did something that you can't construe as flight at all, which is that they would protest that blacks were moving into their neighborhood. They would do this by, you know, throwing things through the windows at night, a rock with a threatening note attached to it. Sometimes they would mob. There would be 10 or 100 or in some cases thousands of people, white people would gather outside of the home that a black person had moved into and make it clear that blacks were not welcome in that neighborhood.
And again, this was happening everywhere, not specifically Milwaukee necessarily.
Absolutely. I think the best research on this topic is in Detroit. There's also research for Chicago. But clearly, in many northern cities around the country in the 1950s and 1960s, whites who thought that blacks would move into their neighborhood didn't just get up and leave. What they did was let blacks know, you are not welcome here. And I think there's no way you can call that white flight, because whites were defending their neighborhoods in their view. They were staying as long as they could.
But of course, at a certain point, there are the numbers indicating that whites did leave certain areas, as you indicated before, did leave the participation in certain institutions that blacks were part of. What were the effects of whites doing this? What then happened?
In neighborhoods that whites left, certain things changed and certain things didn't change. In neighborhoods where black homeowners could move in and maintain their properties to the standard that had previously been upheld by the whites, the neighborhoods, while they had a different complexion and maybe a different kind of ethnic flavor, if you will, looked a lot like they had looked before. But in other cases, the neighborhoods changed in a way that whites regarded as decline, and in fact that other sometimes African-American middle-class people also thought of as decline. And the reason for this is that it was not easy for African-Americans to get access to that housing in the first place. Cast your mind back actually all the way to the 1930s and think here about the federal government. As part of the New Deal, there were all sorts of new federal programs, and one of those programs was administered by the Federal Housing Administration, and it was supposed to encourage homeownership in the United States. But what happened is the FHA drew maps of cities around the country, and they classified neighborhoods in cities according to the kind of people who lived there. Were they rich white people? Were they middle-class white people? Were they working-class white people? Or were they African Americans? And what they did was literally to draw lines around neighborhoods, red lines. This is where the term redlining comes from, that said A-level neighborhoods, the rich white neighborhoods, are good places to make investments. And any neighborhood that had an African-American was regarded as a C or D-level neighborhood, a neighborhood that while the federal government might be willing to lend some money, private banks would not be willing to lend the money once they had that information. So what happened is that whites could get mortgages pretty easily. And this actually creates the 30-year self-amortizing mortgage that many people have on their homes today that we think of as the normal or standard loan. And African Americans couldn't get those homes. Nonetheless, blacks wanted to buy houses just like many other Americans did. But they couldn't get those loans, and so they had to find other mechanisms with which to finance their properties if they were able to buy. So they worked hard, they saved up money. Then they had to go around to lending institutions that weren't banks that were willing to help them get financing. It's clear in the case of Chicago, and I have found one example of this in Milwaukee as well, that there was a mechanism used called contract sales.
And what is that?
A contract sale is this really devious kind of mechanism for selling a property. Basically, what it says is it's like a rent-to-own agreement. Basically, if you want to buy a house on contract, you put down a down payment. That sounds like a mortgage. And you have to make monthly payments. But you don't get title to the property. You don't become the owner of the property until you have paid off the entirety of the loan. So there's high interest rates and there's a very high risk of losing your property. And what happened is that if you missed a single payment on your property, the original seller would repossess it from you. And the people who were contract sellers knew this and they were happy because they got those down payments and they got all the monthly payments and then they could start all over again with a new person. And these were expensive ways of selling and buying a house. And so families put every member of their family to work, right? And this would result sometimes in overcrowding of neighborhoods, of houses, of neighborhoods, of schools. And in the view of whites who are leaving these neighborhoods, this was bad use of property, and they would therefore regard the neighborhood as being in decline. They didn't see how hard their new neighbors were working and how hard their new neighbors were trying to make it a good neighborhood and to keep themselves in their new homes. All they saw was, oh, there's a lot more people in the neighborhood. Oh, and by the way, they're black people that I don't want to live by particularly. So it was a complex mixture of white people's racism and an institutional system that failed to allow African Americans to buy houses on fair terms that contributed to what whites saw as the decline of neighborhoods.
Getting back to something you talked about earlier, which was these almost dual reasons that influenced whites to leave, not wanting to live in a, quote, deteriorated neighborhood where maybe whites felt their home values weren't as high as they'd once been. But that, combined with racism, how did that play out?
Yeah, well, just think about it for a moment from the point of view of a white homeowner in the 1950s or the 1960s. Even if they were a person who had a liberal heart, who heard the message coming out of the South about how evil segregation was and how evil racism was, even if that person heard that message and didn't want to be a racist anymore, these financial pressures made them think about leaving anyway, doing something that appeared racist, even if they didn't feel like they were racist in their heart. So when they looked at a black neighbor moving in, a white person might try to stay for a while. Try to stay in that neighborhood and create an integrated neighborhood. And in fact, there were community organizations that tried to create successfully integrated neighborhoods, especially in the later part of the 1960s after the civil rights movement had really come onto the national stage. But when they witnessed the overcrowding, the deterioration of facilities, and the prospect of never being able to recoup the investment that they had personally made in their properties, then many of them decided to cut and run, to leave before they lost even more of their, what they thought of as their investment. Now, I do want to say a word about property values, because this is a really important piece of the story. This is a period in which there's a very clear dual housing market in the United States. There are two housing markets. There's a white housing market and a black housing market. When a white person sold a piece of property in a changing neighborhood, they did lose money. And they were right to think of themselves as people who were losing money because they might have, say, bought a house for $15,000. This was a period when that's what a house cost, $15,000. And then when they tried to sell it, because of the process of changing neighborhoods, they would maybe get $5,000 or $10,000 back, depending on when they finally, as they say, gave up and decided to sell out. The African-American family who bought that property, however, didn't usually buy it for that $5,000 or that $10,000. Because of these intervening mechanisms, these contract sales that I was talking about earlier, in the contract sale process, somebody other than the contract buyer owned the property in the intermediate period, and they could then sell the property to that black contract buyer for a dramatically inflated rate. So the contract buyer, the new black homeowner, might be paying $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 for that property that the white seller had sold for at a loss for $5,000. So there's dramatic profits to be made by those real estate dealers who are right in the middle. And so while whites lost property value, blacks didn't pay less. They paid more in this dual housing market.
How do those situations from the past continue to impact what we see going on in our neighborhoods today?
Well, I think it's very complicated now in metropolitan Milwaukee. On the one hand, we have fair housing laws that say you as a home seller or a landlord can't deny somebody access to renting or buying your property on the basis of race. And it has been possible with a growing black middle class for African Americans to move into a variety of previously white areas that they wouldn't have had access to in prior years. And because of a great cultural shift that came about because of the moral power of the Southern Civil Rights Movement, not all whites move out anymore when African Americans move in. So I know that the neighborhood that I live in Glendale is a peacefully integrated neighborhood. African Americans lived there when I moved in 6 or 7 years ago, and whites have continued to come in to the neighborhood, and nobody makes a fuss. And while we might notice each other's race, we in my neighborhood don't seem to be particularly worried about it. So in that sense, I don't see white flight happening very much, at least where I live. However, just because mortgages became available in the 1970s to a much broader swath of the population doesn't mean that all the problems have been solved. And I think that, I don't know if this research has been done, but if you try to trace out what happened to people who had previously bought on contract, for example, they would probably be the people who are using subprime loans today to buy properties in a way that is very disruptive to American communities. So I think exploitation still exists, but it exists alongside some cases of peaceful integration.
So is it naive to say that white flight isn't still happening? Or, you know, has it changed in how it's occurring?
Well, as I said earlier at the outset, I'm kind of a skeptic about the term white flight to begin with. I think that there are certainly whites who don't still in the 21st century want to live next to African Americans. But I think to understand the processes whereby neighborhoods change in their racial composition or their class composition, you have to look at a lot of other factors, economic factors, as well as racial perceptions.
Well, Amanda Seligman, we could probably talk about this for a while, but unfortunately we're out of time now. Thank you so much for coming in and explaining to us the idea behind so-called white flight.
Thank you so much for inviting me today.
Amanda Seligman is a professor of history and the director of the Urban Studies program at UWM. She spoke with Stephanie Lecce. And that's all the time we have today. Our Project Milwaukee series continues all this week on both Lake Effect and in our daily news reports. On Tuesday, the WUWM newsroom will have a report on what interracial families have to say about race relations. The stories will also feature frank conversation with school children on their attitudes about race. On Lake Effect, we'll continue the conversation with a discussion on when kids are first aware of race, plus what were the factors that came together to create and then destroy Bronzeville. All of our Project Milwaukee stories are available online at wuwm.com/Project Milwaukee. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for being with us today. Join us again tomorrow for more of Lake Effect, 10 in the morning and 11 at night on 89.7 WUWM HD, Milwaukee Public Radio.